Part 1, Chapter 16, The Delusion of Dialectics. In the preceding chapter, we tried to allow you partake of a new insight into nature with the aim of leading you to self-knowledge, which is the door to the mysteries of the divine man. We discovered the naked reality of the essence of dialectics. We saw that the life pillar of dialectical man produces various deadly radiations and forces which would immediately destroy him existentially and make his existences completely impossible were it not for the existence of some natural realms in our world order which draw their life substance from these forces and therefore partially absorb the deadly radiations of mankind. The fact that dialectical man exists renders the various subhuman natural realms necessary. These realms owe their origin, their appearance, to our deadly miasmata, to our manifestation reality. From this it is evident how much they are one with us and are proofs of the causes of our fate, of our karma. Therefore, although intended as our life preservers, they are simultaneously our menace, our enemies, and in accordance with their original cause of existence, they are also in conflict with each other. Dialectical man produces a powerful, manifold, unholy, pernicious force. Although this unholy force is temporarily and partially suppressed by the presence of the natural realms concerned, it will in time catch up with him in different ways, due to the effect of the law of causality. Thus the true seeker of the path of liberation perceives in what a horrid world order he lives and how, merely through the functions of his being, he is an accessory to the general world tragedy. He is convinced that he exists and participates with his whole microcosm in an undivine world order. Therefore, his whole heart thirsts for God, for an absolute divine reality by which he knows himself to be called. Thus, the pupil becomes more and more conscious of his wretched dialectical reality. Whoever does not yet possess this self and world-perceiving consciousness will continue to try to obtain fulfillment of his wishes on the horizontal line. He will continue his strivings for earthly pleasures and pursue what is known as the best gifts of the earth. He will exult in supposed possessions and feel deeply hurt when they vanish like a mirage. This pursuit and disappointment will come and go many times. They will keep the person extremely busy for many years, perhaps for many lives, until, due to persisting painful experiences, the reality of the true insight into nature finally dawns on his consciousness. Then the seeker experiences the truth of the words of Proverbs: "All is vanity and vexation of spirit. Everything here is deception, a phantom, absolute delusion. Moreover, all this brings and constitutes immeasurable pain and indescribable tragedy." Therefore, he stops all his strivings on the horizontal line, as well as regards thinking, feeling, wanting, and acting, and lifts his eyes to the hills from whence his help comes. As long as you still seek for life realization in this nature, as long as you still pursue civil, social, political or humanistic aspiration in this order of nature, you do not as yet share this point of view. You cannot be forced to this point of view, nor can you elevate yourself to it by decision. You must grow towards it, mature towards it by experience. You must through experience possess the knowledge that your life pillar produces and spreads death in all its activities, that this death is taken up by what you call life realms, but that the latter have nothing in common with life and transmit your deadly products anew in countless other forms. In this way, your deadly forces unleash and spread disaster, and therefore your existence, in the truest sense, produces grief, suffering, and death. When you do possess this knowledge, this insight, you no longer wish to participate in this maelstrom of torment, because firstly, you have tasted dialectical reality right to the dregs, and secondly, you will no longer fall prey to any delusion whatsoever. These are the two pillars upon which pupilship must be based, because they enable man to direct himself completely towards the one goal of divine reality. Only then can he truly seek for and knock upon the door of the divine mysteries. Unto him is said, "Seek, and you will find; knock, and it will be opened to you." Only then can he voice the true cry for salvation. Our prayers for help are usually the consequence of incidental troubles caused by our concessions to delusion and our lack of true insight into nature. When one trouble has just disappeared, we are often diligently at work creating the causes for another difficulty. However, the prayer for help to which the Brotherhood always responds is the consequence of a state of the soul in which clearly resides the words of the Buddha. The perception that if this earth were all that the poets dreamed of, if all disaster were swept away, every pain brought to an end, every joy made more profound, every beauty more sublime, even if everything here were raised to the summit of perfection, the soul would still become weary of it all and, freed of all desires, turn away from that. This dialectical earth has then become a prison for the soul, and however nicely it may be adorned, the soul longs for the free and unrestricted atmosphere beyond the surrounding walls, and the so-called heavenly world of the reflection sphere has for it as little attraction as the material sphere. It is weary of this too. These celestial joys have completely lost their power of attraction. One's own mental and emotional enjoyments no longer give even the slightest satisfaction. Indeed, they too come and go, transitory as they are, just like the perceptions of the senses. They are limited, temporary, unsatisfying. The soul is weary of all these changes, and out of this weariness, it cries aloud for liberation. Many seekers will at some time or other have known something of this state of being, of this idea of the worthlessness of everything. It was mostly nothing more than a glimpse of consciousness, after which superficial things again established their total control, and the glamour of delusion with its seductive joys once again lulled the soul into a state of contentment. You will understand that delusion often presents itself to us as joy, beauty, and glory. The delusion of this world possesses many perspectives which, to a certain extent, are highly respectable and noble. These perspectives are suggested to us by forces which do their utmost to make of this world an order acceptable to the gnosis and in harmony with it. These suggestions can, in a certain respect, be called noble and respectable too. Thus, years and lives can pass filled with these noble deeds. Our days can be filled with numerous utterly selfless endeavors. We are burdened with humane activities. We want to improve and heal mankind. We pursue a whole series of practical ideals and rejoice at every milestone. The stamp of all this unselfish endeavor, of all these efforts, of all this struggle, expresses itself in our entire personality. Our eyes speak of the remoteness at which we gaze, of all we assume to be certain in the future. Assume to be certainty, but that is delusion, and delusion is mental illness, madness. If we pay close attention, we see this madness glowing like fire behind the pupils of the eyes. This fire of delusion burns very strongly in the world. Art, science, and natural religion demonstrate this. It blazes in natural occultism and humanism. This lake of fire, this burning flame, is not kindled by conscious, deliberate wickedness, but rather these red flaming tongues ascend to heaven in a continuous, potent effort to make this world order acceptable and to make all divine powers work for this plan. The largest natural occult brotherhood of all times works at the execution of this plan, but without even the slightest success. It has trodden all paths in order to attain its goal, and though its intention was originally noble and unselfish from a certain point of view, It began in the distant past to use force in order to achieve its aims at any cost. But force requires power, and the assertion of power requires means of power. Do you recognize the tragedy of this brotherhood, the absolute consequence of madness? It plunged itself into an immeasurably deep abyss. In order to eliminate all opposed to it, it instituted its own law, established courts of justice, and passed sentences. In order to execute a sentence, the respective means are necessary. And so the means were provided. Thus, prisons, torture chambers, murder, and killing came into being. So there was and is an almost general imprisonment of all mankind. We are prisoners of this nature, not only by our natural state, but also as a result of the magic of the brotherhood concerned. In every district of our cities, in every village and settlement in a huge part of the world, there are buildings in which the magic of permanent imprisonment is exercised, so that countless millions of men and women lie bound, body and soul, and other millions are restricted in their freedom of movement to a great extent. By very ancient methods deriving from ancient Atlantis, pernicious ether preparations are radiated into the atmosphere hour by hour. Numerous black magic subcurrents are therefore an inevitable accompanying phenomenon of the once noble goal born of the fundamental delusion of dialectics. Just as the said brotherhood has the material sphere firmly in its grasp, so too is its power firmly founded in the reflection sphere. There, too, it rules together with its companions through magic. After this explanation, you can perhaps imagine what it means when a person is excommunicated by these natural occultists. Such a person is struck by a radiation, personally directed and opposed to his or her life vibration, both here and in the reflection sphere. What this means for someone who knows nothing of the liberating life you can probably imagine. When such a person dies, he or she is immediately haunted in the hereafter by a violent, disquieting force, so that he is usually very quickly urged to an incarnation completely determined for him by outside forces. We confront you with this reality which leaves none of us untouched in order to show you where all delusion invariably leads. First, there is Judas, the noble one, the great idealist, the man who wants to be a fisherman and savior of men. Then Judas is called as a disciple, and as such, takes over the administration of goods of exceptional value. When the path of Christ leads out of this nature and the voice resounds, "My kingdom is not of this world," Judas, because he has no knowledge of nature and does not see through the delusion, and consequently is neither able nor willing to go the path, will first be a strategist and seek a compromise, only later to end with treason and murder. Yet this evil, born of the goodness of this world, this irresistible dialectical law transmuting all good things into bad, is not able to seize a single child of the Gnosis. The result of all worldly strivings, of all organized dialectics, will be self-destruction, like the end of Judas at the very instant the dawn of the morning of resurrection colors the eastern horizon. Therefore, if you wish to set your foot on the path, the hollowness and uselessness of all dialectical manifestations and experiments must become a permanent item of consciousness in your soul. Then you must understand that even the noblest and most unselfish endeavor, begun and carried through in delusion, will sooner or later irrevocably end in crime against the universal light. Without this insight, without attaining this state preparatory to leading to liberation, no one will set foot on the path or enter the first door to the mysteries. But when you have penetrated to this state of consciousness, you stand before the door of the path. Only then will you leave the dusty road of the wheel's revolutions to climb the temple mountain, firmly resolved to escape the slavery of life in the material sphere and reflection spheres, and to gain the freedom on the summit of the mountain of attainment. To set foot on the path does not yet mean to attain the great goal, but to enter a way leading to that goal, a way upon which all things of this nature, inasmuch as they have penetrated the microcosm or become entwined with it, and all things which have been fundamentally spoilt in the microcosm, must to be utterly relinquished, so that step by step all prerequisites are met for transfiguration of the entire being in a new light and a new power. There are pupils who have set their first hesitant steps on the path. They may bask themselves in the grace of the rising dawn. We feel obliged for their sakes, however, to sound a serious warning with the greatest emphasis, because great dangers lurk on the path of transmutation and transfiguration, one of them of a most remarkable nature. If you fall prey to this danger, you first begin to doubt the absoluteness, the reality of the path. Then you will deny the transfigurist path and ultimately be irrevocably driven to deeds directly opposing the spiritual school. Then you will attempt to kill the spiritual school. This triple signature of betrayal, consisting of doubt, denial, and threat, is so utterly classic that one encounters it everywhere in world history, even to the present hour. Think, for example, of Augustine, formerly a pupil of the Manichaeans, who later became one of the founders of the above-mentioned brotherhood. All dialectical brotherhoods in this, as well as in the reflection sphere, with all their hierophants, adepts, and candidates, owe their origin and existence to this great initial danger of the one true path. All dialectical brotherhoods were founded by failed candidates of the transfigurist school, and they fill their ranks with those who, for the same reason, make this experience in our times as well. Thus, doubt, denial, and threat do not approach the school from outside. They originate in the forecourt of the spiritual school. First comes doubt, which is still a negative stage. Then an activity develops which becomes increasingly vehement. The denial, at first harbored in one's own heart, is communicated to others. At first held only in secret, it is declared under a growing inner urge, more and more openly. Then the denial takes shape. It is organized. A plan emerges. And how could it be otherwise? This plan is discovered, just as the first vague signs had already been discerned. When in the spiritual school all come to the table to be fed with the heavenly bread, the morsel is consciously given to those who bear this Judas signature, and the mantramistic words resound, "What you are about to do, do quickly." Thereupon, Judas goes out into the night of his own self in order to proceed from denial to the stage of threat, which can have but one end, one fatal end. How then does this danger arise, to which many a person fell and falls prey? This danger arises through the state of the two persons, the two existences within the microcosm.